So these are some of the images that tell the stories that you probably should know about today. Here they are.
They've lost control of this conflict. Donald Trump is effectively a hostage of Iran. The administration has descended into chaos.
United States of Israel, that's your resume. Killing children every day.
Make Israel great again.
Standards must be met. And not just met, at every level, we should seek to exceed the standard, to push the envelope, to compete. It's common sense. And core to who we are and what we do, it should be in our DNA.
All this in an interview with a U.S. professor who famously said early on that Iran would reap the benefits economically of this war. It's turning out, it's looking like he's going to be right. This is the Sanchez effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And let me just say unequivocally, these are not good days for the Trump administration or for the United States of America. They've certainly had better times. In fact, the situation is really bad right now. I mean, forget everything else. And just look at this quagmire that we've been studying for you, and it's taking place in the Persian Gulf right now to see what's really happening. Look, because it's almost like a catch-22, right? If Mr. Trump declares victory, like he'd love to do, and then walk away tomorrow, well, then the Persians will be in control of the Persian Gulf. They're going to operate it to benefit themselves and their allies, and everybody else is going to have to pay through the nose. If Mr. Trump takes a second tact and he decides, I'm going to blockade that Persian Gulf, or I'm going to use my Navy to go in there and attack the ships, then he's essentially causing the blockage of the Persian Gulf, which is exactly what he's saying he needs to avoid. So the situation that Mr. Trump and the United States finds itself right now in the Persian Gulf is called checkmate. Now, here's my fellow journalist and colleague and friend, Max Blumenthal. He was asked about this. Look how he puts this in perspective.
They've lost control of this conflict. Donald Trump is effectively a hostage of Iran, along with his entire administration. He's surrounded by yes men. The administration has descended into chaos.
So, speaking of chaos, let's talk now about the latest dominoes to fall in this cascading chaos as we're watching it happen. And it's this. It just happened this morning when I woke up. I read the headlines. They have just sacked the Secretary of the Navy in the United States. Here's the headline. Take a look. This is from Politico. It reads that the Navy's secretary is out as the infighting continues in the Pentagon. John Phelan, appointed by President Trump, by the way, just left his job yesterday because of friction with others that are in command, but most notably with Pete Hegseth. In fact, look, at the center of all of this chaos, as it's described by Blumenthal and other people, one name just keeps popping up over and over and over again, which is why I wanted to put the emphasis on this today to talk about this. And if you guess that that name is, in fact, Pete Hegseth, well, then you would be right. It is Pete Hegseth. You would be right. And who is Pete Hegseth, right? He's essentially a former weekend TV announcer who ended up being appointed by Mr. Trump to be the Secretary of Defense for the United States of America. He prefers, by the way, that you call him the Secretary of War, which is kind of ironic when you consider that he's serving a president who was elected on the promise of being against wars and not starting any new wars. So much for that, right? Hegseth joined the National Guard, served in both wars that the U.S. lost in Iraq and Afghanistan. What he was most known for, though, prior to this gig as war secretary, were accusations of sexual assault, drunkenness, and public infidelity. Let me tell you how this begins. It's 2020, the year 2020, and that's when he reportedly paid off a woman who says that he, Hegseth, sexually assaulted her after they both got drunk at a hotel where he had given a speech in California. In the police report, it actually says right there that the victim talked about him physically blocking her from leaving her room. Kind of a big deal. Hegseth has admitted that he paid the woman $50,000 to settle this claim. Then there's his 2025 Senate confirmation hearing. This was tough to listen to, almost embarrassing for him. He was forced to admit that he had cheated on his wife with a woman that he got pregnant. Him and his new girlfriend had a baby, and then he apparently cheated on her. As for reports of his public intoxication and seemingly uncontrollable behavior after consuming alcohol, look, we've all made mistakes. I've had a couple too many drinks from time to time and made mistakes. Maybe you have too. This goes beyond that. These reports are abundant. Here's some examples cast his way.
At a CVA event in Virginia, you needed to be carried out of the event for being intoxicated.
Senator, anonymous true. Smears.
Just true or false? Very simple. Summer of 2014 in Cleveland, drunk in public with the CVA team.
Anonymous smears.
An event in North Carolina, drunk in front of three young female staff members after you had instituted a no alcohol policy and then reversed it. True or false?
Anonymous smears.
You were noticeably intoxicated and had to be carried up to your room. Is that true or false?
Anonymous smears.
You passed out in the back of a party bus. Is that true or false?
Anonymous smears.
Did you take your staff, including young female staff members, to a strip club?
Absolutely not. Anonymous smears.
Could you imagine if somebody said those things about you and they weren't true? Would you just sit there going, anonymous smears? Or would you say, what in the hell are you talking about? Hell no. Where'd you get this stuff, right? This is the way a normal person would react. You'd at least say, that's absolutely false, right? Anonymous smears? Sounds lawyered. Anyway, despite all of that, Secretary of War, Mr. Hegseth, has ironically taken it upon himself to repeatedly lecture high-ranking members of the U.S. military about morality and leadership. He's called for meetings with admirals, four-star generals, three-star generals, military commanders, where he's addressed them on such topics as ethics and propriety and religion. Can you imagine? These are men and women with decades of experience in the military, and they're being told how to behave and how to carry themselves, seriously, by a guy half their age with an admitted questionable past. Here he is, in fact, in front of this. He called this meeting, and he had all these people fly in from all over the world who were at bases around the world that represent the United States. He put a giant flag behind him in a scene meant to recreate the movie Patton. I don't know if you guys are too young or too old, too young to remember, I should say. And then he stood in front of this flag, and he gives his speech about the standards of conduct and operations to these guys. Here's a piece of it.
Standards must be met. And not just met, at every level, we should seek to exceed the standard, to push the envelope, to compete. It's common sense and core to who we are and what we do. It should be in our DNA.
I mean, look, not for nothing, but to say that these paradoxical, if not comical, lectures have not been received well is an understatement by most of these guys in uniform who've been there for decades. That's not to say they're all good guys. There's a lot of problems there, too. But this whole situation where they're now walking away, it's underscored by what seems like a purge that's been taking place among high-ranking military officials in the United States command, more than we've ever seen before. Here's a sample of some of those high-ranking officials who've quit or they've actually been asked to resign. I'll take you through it. Here, General Randy George, Army Chief of Staff, gone, also out. General David Hotney, who was in charge of training and command, gone. So was Major General William Green, the Army Chief of the Chaplains. He's gone. General Charles Brown, Jr., the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he's gone. So is Admiral Lisa Franchetti. She was the Chief of Naval Operations. She's gone. General Jim Schlieff, Air Force's Vice Chief of Staff, gone. As is Lieutenant General Jeffrey Cruz. He's the Director of Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA. So what's worse now is, for both Hegseth and Trump, is that since this apparent purge that I just showed you, Israel and the United States' war against Iran is being characterized by many other military officials who've stuck around and others around the world as a failure of both judgment, military planning, and military competence. In essence, Sloppy. Some have compared this to the Bay of Pigs in 1962 under President Kennedy, which was a disaster. The failed rescue of U.S. hostages under President Carter in 1980, which was also a disaster. Meanwhile, Iran, by all indications, has the upper hand. And as for Hegseth, he's become a bit of a spectacle of late. Not just for the seemingly bad advice that most people are saying that he's given President Trump, but also for his emphasis on things like appearance and makeup and highlights in his hair and some bravado showmanship. What, look at the spoofs they're doing.
Please welcome Secretary Hegseth. Finished my Heg stand and relaxed. It was Sprite.
Now, those leaks enraged the White House, so they sent out former morning show host Pete Hegseth, who, much like Iran's nuclear program, always seems semi-obliterated.
I'm Secretary of War Pete Hegseth. Look, there's a lot of questions lately about what America is up to in Iran, mainly from dummies, morons, and respected geopolitical experts.
For most of the world, this war cannot end soon enough. And today, we got an update from Pete Hegseth, Secretary of Defense and worst part of every Hooters waitress's day. He came out at a press conference this morning, and you can tell he's laser-focused on defeating Iran.
A note to the press corps, to the American media. As I just can't help but notice the endless stream of garbage, the relentlessly negative coverage.
Okay, right. Well, no, obviously he has to defeat the American media first, but then Iran.
Some of it is funny, but look, there's more. Hegseth's latest gaffe occurred when he confused a Bible verse with a scene from a movie. This actually just happened. The secretary has a habit of answering reporters' questions about specifics when they say, what's going on in Iran? What happened here? What happened there? Instead, he gives them Bible quotes. But recently, he quoted what he apparently thought was a Bible verse, but it turned out to actually be a line from the movie Pulp Fiction. Ouch. So look, here's the problem. Here's the problem for Mr. Hegseth and for the administration. Iran right now is seen to be winning the war on the ground, in the Gulf, and in the entire region. And there's something else they're winning. They're winning the hearts and minds of people all over the world. And part of how they've done that, by the way, aside from the obvious, is with a brilliant, seriously, a brilliant public relations and marketing campaign that's being waged using AI. Who would have thunk it, right? Iran. The campaign deploys incredibly well-produced AI cartoons and memes that are now being seen regularly by hundreds of millions of people all over the world. These are like cartoons and memes that are animated Legos. Have you seen these? You've probably seen a clip of them and maybe you weren't sure what they are. It's almost like the producers who are creating these are inside the minds of many Americans who are actually thinking these things. Here, I'm going to give you an example of what I'm talking about. This first one, I'm going to show you about, I think, three or four of them. This first one is about Pete Hegseth. Watch.
Yo, Pete Hegseth. This one's specially for you. You punk-ass rapist straight from Iran. Your tattoo-covered clown with that cafe ink on your arm. Think you a crusader? Nah, just a drunk infidel in a fake uniform. Chain to kill all Muslims, wasted in the hotel lobby. Sexual assault settlement in Monterey. Blocked the door, took a phone, paid her off quiet, cause me too was on.
This is amazing, cause they're produced, and you know what they're produced for? Young people. And they're constantly being shared by Iran's embassies all over the world, and sometimes they're customized. And they're hitting Mr. Trump, and they're hitting Mr. Trump's team, people like Hegseth, where it hurts. It's a constant theme of usually some of the top things that they address or target are Epstein and America being run by Israel. Here's an example of that.
United States of Israel. That's your resume. Killing children every day.
Make Israel great again.
Your government is run by pedophiles.
They ordered you to die for Israel.
They're just using you for now. Wanna see the real truth? Watch how they talk on Jesus.
America. By the way, there's one theme they also keep coming back to. It's the most watched theme and the one that has really fired people up all over the world. You know, this made a lot of people sad all over the world when they watched the actual event and then the videos that came after it. And these are the videos that they produced, again, using Legos, that tell the story of these schoolgirls that were burned alive during the initial U.S. and Israeli assault on Iran. Watch. You know, as I'm watching these, I'm thinking it's almost like somebody's out Hollywooding Hollywood. It used to be only Hollywood could. But with AI, somebody can do these in their basement nowadays, which is really what's fascinating about this. Even Zelensky, by the way, Ukraine Zelensky, he was just thrown into one of these, into this mix. He's cast as a drone expert offering help to Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu. This one's kind of funny, actually. So it's effective. It's effective. And by the way, did you know this? Aside from other things that we've been talking about since we started here, that Iran has actually become much stronger economically as a result of this war. Weird, right? Their oil is now, I don't know, 3-4 times more valuable. Their currency, the real, compared to when I was there. Remember I told you about what was going on there that led to the protest? It's also worth a lot more now than it was before the war. Their global image has surpassed just about every single country in the Middle East. And they're all now looking up at them, right? I mean, this is a country that could now end up being instrumental in ending the so-called petrodollar that has been there for, what, 50, 60, 70 years? 80? So how'd we get here? How'd we get to this situation? And who would have thunk it, as we say, right? All right, here to answer that for us now is Professor Steve Hanke, who famously, by the way, he put out one of the most famous first viral posts declaring that Iran was winning the war economically. He teaches at Johns Hopkins University. Yay. He's an economist. Thank you, Professor, for joining us and spending some time with us here today. It's so great to see you.
Well, great to see you, Rick. As kind of a segue, let me begin with a footnote on Hegseth. Actually, there's quite a scholarly book that really lays it all out. Hmm. It was written in 1976 by Norman Dixon, and it's called On the Psychology of Military Incompetence. And he looked at the great British military disasters and analyzed those in some detail and came up with the three key things and features of the military incompetence, the psychology of military incompetence, were that the belief that warfare is always about muscles and not about minds. Two, most of those who were in charge of the military were anti-intellectual and anti-education. Mm. And three, all of the military disasters the British had were the result of muscular Christianity.
That's fascinating, because that defines him to a T, doesn't it?
It's all in Dixon's book, and it fits Hegseth just to a T. It summarizes in a very heavy-duty way everything you summarized in your reporting right before you had me come on.
Yeah, and that's where we are. Meanwhile, you look, you've advised Congress, you've advised Reagan, Lithuania, Venezuela, Bulgaria, Indonesia, Argentina, Estonia, Ecuador, and I could go on. You have seen these situations in countries before, and that's why maybe early on you said Iran will win this situation and is already economically. I'm wondering, since you made that declaration and one of the first ones to do it, what are the metrics that you're using to come to that conclusion, Professor?
Well, the bottom line is geography. Geography is always very important, and it's very clear that at the end of the day, Iran will have a major role in the control of the Strait of Hormuz. And as we all know, you have a lot of economic activity, very important, significant economic activity that goes through the strait. And I think the most ideal situation would be something like the Montreux Convention of 1936 that dealt with the Dardanelles and the Bosphorus. And the end result was that those waterways would be managed by Turkey, and Turkey would be allowed to charge management fees for the passage going through the Bosphorus and the Dardanelles. So that would be a win-win for everybody. But ultimately, who's either you run the show or the show is running you? And I think in the case of the Strait, geography dictates, and Iran will be running the show.
Is it impossible for Mr. Trump to undo this? Or is he in a catch-22? Is he checkmated right now?
I think he's completely checkmated, because let us assume that the blockade continues. Let's go with this scenario, because the blockade, I think, was a very ill-advised move on the part of the United States, because it really plays into Iran's hand, because what does it do? It chokes off the strait even more than it was. It was functionally inoperative before the blockade. Now it's even more functionally inoperative. And what does that do? It spreads the worldwide economic damage out, makes it, it increases the duration and the strength of the costs that are being spread all over the world. And that is to the advantage of who? Iran. It's to the disadvantage of the United States. So it was quite frankly, a stupid thing to do.
But Mr. Trump would disagree with you, Professor. He would say, no, we don't need it. Besides, by shutting down the, he hasn't said it in these words, but he seems to infer at times that by shutting down the Strait of Hormuz, it's better for the United States because it forces everybody to buy our oil and our hydrocarbons. I've heard him say that.
Well, that is a narrative. And you have to remember, when you're dealing with the president of the United States, there's always a large gap between rhetoric and reality. and the reality is, and you can talk to any economist in the world, right, left, center, or a bureaucrat at the IMF, and they will tell you that the blockage and dysfunction in the Strait of Hormuz is doing enormous damage all over the world, including the United States. The United States is not immune from this. Most of the things that go through the Strait are traded internationally and priced internationally, and those prices, you know, just go to the gas pump.
Yeah.
I mean, Joe Sixpack can even figure this out. Every time he fills his car up, he realizes he's paying over $4 a gallon for gas. And before the war started, he was paying $3 or less. So it doesn't take a rocket scientist or professor of economics to figure this stuff out.
Look at that. Go ahead.
If you think about it now, let's think about the geopolitical implications of this. The costs are being spread. And what does that do? That is now, we're realizing, causing many countries to pivot away from Uncle Sam. They're hedging their bets. They're figuring out how to get away from Uncle Sam. They're not embracing this. They're against it. Name one major foreign power that is for the blockade right now. They're all trying to figure out how to get the blockade lifted because of the damage being imposed. And when you look at economic forecasts, the IMF meetings last week, the new forecast came out for world economic growth and the world economic outlook of the IMF. And they notched it down from 3.4% to 3.1%. But let us that assumes that this thing's going to be wound up pretty rapidly. Let's assume that it stays until maybe the middle of the summer, the blockade, which they're talking about, that kind of thing. If that happens, I'll tell you, that forecast will go from 3.1 to zero or minus. We'll end up with a world in a major recession. The longer it goes, the further down the economic activity goes. That's ultimately the way to think about the thing. So every day the blockade is kept in place, and every time they don't come to some accommodation with Iran, which, as far as the strait goes, they hold the cards.
Yeah, yeah. I went there. I think you may have seen some of my coverage. I spent like a week or more just before the bombs started falling in Iran. And I talked to the officials there, and I talked to the people there. I talked to the mullahs. I talked to everybody I could put a microphone in front of. And I found them to be a very resilient people, but I also found that at the time they were angry at their own government, very angry at their own government, because their economy, frankly, sucked. I mean, they were in a tough way. The rial was unbelievably inflated. They felt like they weren't getting the right price for their goods. And they were just paying too much stuff for stuff. And they also complained that there was a lot of corruption in the country. It seems to me, based on readings from people like you, like those problems that I saw there then are kind of gone now. Is that right?
Well, let me, first of all, the narrative you were picking up in the street is what it is. I'm not arguing with that.
Yeah.
But if you look at the data, Rick, and look at the GDP per capita growth rate from 2008 until prior to the war at the end of 2024, you end up, if you index these numbers, which I've done, and starting at 2008 at 100, and then you go up to the end of 2024, you have the growth rate in Saudi Arabia and in Iran being almost identical.
Really?
Now, let's keep that index. It goes from about 100 to about 124.
Pure GDP.
Okay.
Pure GDP.
For GDP per capita.
Per capita.
Per person. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's one thing. Now, if you look at Kuwait's GDP goes from 100 down to 59. There's a huge contraction. The UAE, everybody advertises the UAE. It goes from 100 down to about 89. Qatar goes down. Oman goes down. All the Gulf cooperation states, with the exception of Saudi Arabia, actually went down from 2008 until 2024. The only Gulf countries that experienced growth per capita GDP with Saudi Arabia and Iran, and their growth rates were almost identical.
So how do you explain that? Because we're told that these are the rich countries and Iran was the not-so-rich country. Was it, I'm just imagining, because of the sanctions that the United States was putting on them, was keeping their people from getting access to that, to their money?
Well, no. The numbers are the numbers. The numbers accounted for the sanctions. If the sanctions hadn't been on, the numbers would be higher, obviously.
Wow.
But the thing is, and what you were getting on the street, and what we get generally coming out of the Gulf, It's something called propaganda, Rick.
I know.
Rick, you're a journalist. You have to remember Hanke's 95% rule. Hanke's 95% rule is 95% of what you read in the press is either wrong or irrelevant.
Yeah, I know. I know.
So let's talk about the currency. Now, you mentioned the currency.
Yeah.
You are on top of that.
Yeah.
And we had the war start. And all the propaganda was filling the papers saying essentially the narrative that you just gave, that the currency was collapsing. You had people out in the streets fomenting, revolts and so forth and so on.
Yeah.
Okay. The fact of the matter is after that, the real was declining and a steady decline before the war, okay?
Yes.
Getting weak. Yeah. It wasn't collapsing. It was just steadily getting weaker, weaker, weaker. And the inflation rate, by the way, was pretty high. Measure it. I'm the only one in the world who measures the daily inflation in Iran. And it was running between about 80 and 90%, very high inflation.
Yes.
And it declining. Then the war starts. And what happens? This is what we call an event study. So the event is the war. And you want to look at what happened after the war started, after that event. The real starts appreciating. It's now appreciated 13% against the U.S. dollar since the war started. And inflation has done what? It's come down. It's not gone up.
How is that?
So inflation's come down. And the reason for that, by the way, is very simple, because the exports of oil from Iran have increased significantly since the war started, and they've been selling those at a lot higher prices and with lower discounts.
Hmm.
So the revenue coming into the treasury after the war is greater than it was before the war.
So the price of oil has gone up. So that in and of itself makes Iranian oil a premium, makes it more expensive. They make more money off of it. And then they get exclusive access to the Persian Gulf, where before they used to share it. So they're able to help China and literally get more of their supplies out over other countries. That's basically right.
That's correct. Plus the fact that one thing that people don't realize is that before the war started, they had shipped a lot of oil out that's floating. There are 180 million barrels of Iranian oil that are floating out there, and they supply most of that goes to these teapot small refineries in China. About 1.8 million barrels a day. So if you divide 1.8 into 180, what do you get? You get the revenue. Even if they totally blockaded and sealed off completely Iran, the money would keep rolling in until the end of July because the oil's outside the Gulf already. So This is a gang who can't shoot straight, the United States and Israel. Of course, Israel is, whenever you talk about the war, you've got three parties. You've got the United States, Israel, and Iran. In my judgment, Israel actually calling most of the shots, not the United States.
Mm.
So when they look at this thing and these negotiations in Islamabad, the first phase anyway, We'll wait and see when the second shoe drops, but it's the U.S. and Iran. But there's a third party involved, and that's Israel.
Yeah. What happens? Let's say a year or two from now. You're a guy who's famous for looking at situations and telling us what will likely happen economically in the future. What happens with a vibrant Iran in control of the Persian Gulf? And who are the countries who benefit from that? I imagine countries like Russia and China and India. And conversely, what are the countries that will not be benefiting from this situation? How do you see it, Professor?
Well, generally, to get into the details, it's very difficult. All you end up with is a big range of scenarios.
Right.
But the general picture, I think will be accurate, and that is that there'll be a major pivot away from the United States and its allies in the Gulf, and the position of Iran will be enhanced. Russia obviously is a huge winner. China is a huge winner. And India will be a huge winner. Basically, the BRICS, or Global South, are coming out as winners in this thing. So strategically, as it turns out, the United States just doesn't know how to play chess.
You know, it's funny. I was
they haven't thought any of these things through.
Well,
in other words, even the economic implications, the narrowly focused economic cost. We had 2 weeks ago, Russell Vogt, who's the director of the Office of Management and Budget, testified before the U.S. Congress, and they asked him how much, in terms of the budget now, narrow cost, small cost, will the war cost? And Vogt said, we don't have any idea. So that shows you they're going into something without a plan, without even any tentative calculations of how much the darn thing is going to cost. And by the way, even when you look at these cost numbers, you know, the cost estimate before we invaded Iraq was a number. And the final number was 50,000 times higher than the initial estimate.
Oh.
So these cost estimates that you get, we don't have one, by the way, for Iran yet. We don't have a cost estimate. But we will get one momentarily, I'm sure, in the next few weeks. And believe me, it will be lowballing the thing tremendously.
Do you get a feel the American people, guys like you and me, and hopefully others, are finally coming to their wits and asking questions about why it is that their money is being used for stupid stuff like this, as it was done, many would argue, from Vietnam through Syria, through Libya, through Iraq, through Afghanistan, and on and on?
Well, the answer to that is yes. If you look at the polling numbers, look at the polling numbers on Trump. They're tanking big time.
Yeah, bad.
He has huge negative numbers on the economy, and you know, he's a master spin meister, making America great again. But the fact is, the first year he was in office, the GDP growth was lower in 2025 than in 2024. Productivity was lower in 2025 than in 24. Manufacturing jobs, actually, remember, the tariff man was going to generate lots of manufacturing jobs with these tariffs?
No.
We lost 108,000 manufacturing jobs in 2025, and the total number of jobs added in the economy was only 181,000 in 2025. It was 2.2 million in 2024. So in short, everything is getting worse.
Yeah, and getting
from an economic point of view, you got to forget the spin, and Joe Sixpack understands that.
And it's getting better for countries that many Americans, you know, have often been told are not the good guys, right? I mean, I was just looking at Gazprom. Gazprom, the big oil company in Russia, they just reported their forecasted EBITDA for next year. They're up $3 billion, or up to $38 billion. I mean, you know, you look at what's happening with China, and I want to hear you address this, but I would think that a revitalized Iran with a strong economy in cooperation with Russia and China, in combination somehow with an India and a South Africa and maybe even a Brazil from the other side of the world, boy, that would be a hell of a formidable foe for the Western alliances that you and I have always grown up with, no?
Well, yes, and under that scenario, you're right. But we have to be very careful about this, Rick.
Okay.
The pivot will occur, and the pivot away from the United States will occur. But you have to realize the United States, there are three great powers in the world:
mm-hmm.
the United States, China, and Russia. Okay. nothing else really counts that much, quite frankly. And the pivot will be away from the United States. But the thing is, the United States is the greatest power, without a doubt. And just looking at the economics, you realize that two-thirds of all the market capitalization of all the stocks trading in the world are denominated in U.S. dollars. So the dollar is king. It will remain king. Forget the de-dollarization nonsense that people talk about. It's not going to happen. The dollar's use and spread actually has grown slightly over time, over the last 2 or 3 years. So we haven't de-dollarized. Actually, more use has occurred in proportion to the total use of currencies in the world. The euro has gone down a little bit the last 2 or 3 years, and the Chinese yuan has gone up quite a bit, but from a very, very low base.
Well, if not the let me ask you this then. If not the dollar itself, how about the petrodollar? If Iran insists in making sure that all the business that's transacted through the Strait of Hormuz in the future is done in yuans, Chinese currency, wouldn't that have an effect, a deleterious effect?
That has a superficial effect on the surface, but the question is, where are you ultimately going to put those yuan that you've settled your transaction in? You're going to exchange them for dollars and put them into U.S. dollar assets, because the dollar is the only large liquid market now. Let's go back to the start of the petrodollar. That started in 1971. Nixon closed the gold window, and then shortly after that, 1973, we had the Yom Kippur War, and the money started pouring into the Gulf. Now, where did the money go? What were they going to do with it? They literally, the Saudi Arabian Central Bank had six people. They only had six people working on this. They had so much money coming in, they didn't know what to do with it. And what happened is Kissinger, at the time, was clever enough to arrange a deal, a petrodollar deal, in which the Saudis would basically go through the front door when the treasury auctions occurred before everybody else, and they would buy U.S. treasuries. And it was a very good deal for the United States. It started the petrodollar recycling. But the reality is there was no other place to put the money. The only liquid capital market is in New York. And so it kept up. And now all these Gulf states, instead of putting 100% in U.S. dollars, they try to diversify their portfolios and put them in other currencies and so forth. But it's very constrained, Rick, and very limited.
Is it going to get...
You can't hide from the U.S. dollar, basically.
Well said. Would it not incentivize the Persian Gulf states, everything from, you know, Qatar to Oman to UAE to the Saudis, Kuwait, whatever, to somehow separate themselves from the dominion on them that the United States holds, based just, hell, militarily on what just happened to them with all those bases? Do you expect, how do you foresee these nations, these Persian Gulf countries, acting a year from now or as a result of this war? What do you see as a change?
The natural reaction to increased risk and uncertainty is to hedge.
Right.
And I anticipate that they'll hedge, but again, it won't be a situation where they can institute a perfect hedge. That's my point. This is harder to do than you think.
So they'll invite China and Russia in, but they won't. But they'll still be dollared.
Right. I mean, remember you have the Chinese yuan. The Chinese yuan, as I say, the use of the yuan has increased percentage-wise as a proportion of the total activity a lot. There's no question about it. But from a very tiny base, I mean, it's less than 10%. of the total picture. And it will not be able to be used very widely and not very desirable because there are capital controls in China. And we have to put the whole thing into perspective. Let's go back 2,500 years. And if we start 2,500 years ago, okay, take notes, Rick.
I am.
If we go back 2,500 years, and there's always one international currency that dominates. At any particular time, there's one king on the throne.
Huh.
And you know how many kings there have been in 2,500 years? 14. Only 14. So what's the point? The point is, it's hard to knock a king off the throne.
Hmm. Let me ask you this about something we talked about at the beginning. Is there any way that, short of obviously nuclear weapons, but let's not go there, is there any other way that Iran could be defeated at this point economically?
Well, I suppose if you want to turn Iran into it, which they're trying to do, but mm-hmm. it's very difficult. It's a big place, and this would include the Strait. If you turn that into Gaza, that would do the job.
But it's yeah.
But you'd have to do that. You'd have to get the Strait.
Right.
Yeah. So this would be a complete catastrophic result for internationally. I mean, obviously for Iran it would be catastrophic.
Yeah, your point is yeah, you do that in Gaza, it doesn't affect the world economy. You do that in the Strait of Hormuz, you blow it up in essence, and it affects the world economy, including, as you said, the United States.
It affects the world economy. Plus, right away, you know that the Red Sea would be closed.
Why would the Red Sea?
So you'd have there are 8 big checkpoints in the world, and you'd have 2 of them closed.
Wow, that would be, by my estimation, something like 40% of the supplies in the world would not be able to go through those places.
Right. So the point is, let's not talk about the ultimate wipeout, but just the escalation ladder is where you don't want to go. Because if you go up the escalation ladder, you are inviting a full closure of the Strait, number one. Number two, lots more damage to oil facilities in the Gulf. There have already been 80 facilities that have been damaged in the Gulf as the Iranians have counterattacked, and a third of those have been severely damaged. And it will take up to 2 years just to repair those severely damaged facilities. So this isn't going, the point yeah. there, it, even now, it isn't going away fast. The idea that if you come to some settlement, which by the way, is not going to happen. Remember how long it took Henry Kissinger to wind down the Vietnam War?
Mm-hmm.
4 years. He was commuting to Paris and the Lutetia Hotel in Paris, over and over and over again, trying to wind down the war. So you've got amateurs trying to do this now. The representatives of the United States, they're just, shall we say, this gets into the thing I was talking about earlier with the
Hegseth effect. The Hegseth effect.
Yeah, it's a Hegseth effect. It's the same thing. So you get the Iranians coming to the first meeting at Islamabad, armed for negotiations, technical advisors, people who are competent, and then you get the 3 U.S. representative leaders, the vice president, and his 2 compadres,
Wyckoff and Kushner. Yeah, with no plan.
Yes.
With no plan. Nothing.
No. Well, they didn't plan. This was all theater. They couldn't, and they didn't plan, and they didn't even have the authority to do anything. They had to check with the vice president had to check with the president of the United States and the prime minister of Israel
yeah.
before he could tie his shoes.
That's ugly. Yeah, that's not a good picture. And then the Prime Minister of Israel said that he reports to me. He used the word he reports to me, which
apparently he did.
Yeah, apparently he most definitely did. So let me ask you final question, and I know you're an economist and you're brilliant, but let me ask you more of a psychological question. Do some of the things that we just talked about that are important for people to figure out, do you give our president, Mr. Trump, enough credit that you think he'll figure this stuff out and make the right decisions, or how concerned are you that he won't?
Well, I am concerned because the ultimate spoiler in the game is Israel.
Yeah.
I said, we're not just talking about the United States and Iran here. We're talking about there's a threesome going on, and we have one of the three that's a spoiler. I think Trump realizes, because he's a clever enough politician. There's no question about that. Let's face it. That he realizes he's really in trouble.
I do too.
He's boxed in a corner, and an impossible situation. But ultimately, the spoiler will be the one that calls the tune. Again, the key thing is either you run the show or the show runs you. And Trump is not running the show.
And I think he knows it. I think you're right.
Right. And there's not much he can do about it.
Yeah. Professor, you are an absolute delight to talk to. I am so glad that we had a chance to chat. You're so smart. And I'm really glad that you had a chance to spend some time with us. And thank you, by the way, for being so gracious with your time. Appreciate it.
Well, Rick, thanks for inviting me. Good to see you.
We'll do it again. Thank you. So it's time now for your comments on my conversation yesterday when we went in front of that big map, as we often do, with U.S. Army Officer Stas Krapivnik, retired, of course. And we broke down the two different war scenarios, or theaters, as they're often called, for you. And here's Sanyo Fargo, who says, Rick, I really admire how you're cutting through the noise and speaking the truth. It's refreshing to see people with the courage to be honest. I'm glad he thinks that way. By the way, Dave Watts also says, Stanislav is an expert on everything, a real one. Dude is a walking encyclopedia. I agree. I really like him. And a good guy, by the way, a good friend. Zephon, though, says, terrorist doesn't deserve negotiation. He's referring, obviously, to Iran. Demand is what regime deserves. My answer, thank you, Mr. Zephon, but your grammar is atrocious. Lagerbrewer says, I read many hours of this conflict every day and from both sides through back channels. However, Sanchez is not correct in his assessment of this conflict. My answer to you, please, sir, write back and tell me what I got wrong rather than just say it's wrong. Drake976 says, only a complete idiot like Rick Sanchez would post this garbage. The U.S. could bomb Iran back to the 19th century. Nothing Iran could do to stop it. My comment? Yes, they could. Yes, they could. Thank you, John Wayne. Sorry. Also, there's an ESP says, you're a tool of the Iranian government. I see. My comment? No. I'm a tool of reality and honest analysis. And you sound kind of like a tool of CNN's. I should know. I used to work there. Thank you for all the comments, good, bad, indifferent. I have a lot of fun sparring sometimes with y'all. As usual, all the feedback is appreciated. You can check out my social media. We're on X, we're on Spotify, we're on BitChute. We're blowing up BitChute. We'll be, as a matter of fact, taking BitChute through a bit of a brand differentiation very soon. Look for it. New branding for BitChute. Thanks for being with us. And thank you, as I always like to say, for allowing us into your homes. We'll see you next time.